Okay, well, thank you very much for doing this interview. We're at the Roosevelt Institute in Washington, D.C. It is Friday, November 12th, 10 after 2. We are interviewing Eve Smith and with Mrs. Gary Cohen, General Counsel of the FCIC. With me are my colleagues Bruce McWilliams and Randall Dodd. Ms. Smith, we're going to be taping this interview. Is that
okay? That's fine.
And we're likely going to put it up on the web.
That's fine.
Unedited. And with that, thank you very much for agreeing to meet with us. Let me start off the questions. We have a bunch of them that we've done. Could you define what you think the financial crisis was?
Well, there are two elements. One was a narrow aspect of the crisis, and one was the broader aspect. If you talk about the immediate aspect of the crisis, it was a multiple seize-ups of liquidity in the financial system. There were four acute phases. The first one was August-September 2002. The second was year-end 2007. The third one was around the time when Bear Stearns failed. And then the fourth was the protracted period after the Lehman failure. And obviously Bear didn't technically fail. It was rescued, but it was on the verge of failure. So you had the sort of the critical period that was really that even though the markets were wobbly, basically starting as the Fannie Freddie conservatorship, it sort of tipped over with Lehman's failure and then continued basically through December of 2008. The much broader frame is that, in fact, over time, we've had basically escalating financial crises. This was really a culmination of a long period of crises that showed up international. You know, we had a series of rolling international crises. We had the dot-com boom and bust did not result in real systemic damage because that wasn't a result of levered asset plays. But if you look internationally, we had increasing frequency and severity of crises, and then the global financial crisis was the, you know, sort of the culmination of a period of more and more instability in the global financial system.
So do you think the rolling crisis, the Asian crisis, the Mexican crisis, Japan's problems, and all the rest were precursors, or were they part of a systemic problem that finally culminated in the big one?
I would actually say that they were part of the eventual problem, because the responses conditioned the industry in a very bad way. We had, at least as far as the U.S. and the major firms were concerned. And again, if you want to talk about the sort of broader crisis pattern, to go to the causative factors of that, you have to widen the frame even further, because why did we start having these crises in the 90s? What changed that led to that pattern? But, for example, in the 94 crisis, that was actually a bigger wipeout in value than the 1987 crash. And that just isn't widely understood. And it took a fairly small move in interest rates by Alan Greenspan, who didn't realize there were all these leveraged derivative bets piled up the other way. Everybody assumed that it had been bet one way, that the Fed was going to continue to lower rates. And the magnitude of the response relative to the fairly small Fed interest rate move was really quite stunning. And that was basically the beginning of one bad behavior that Greenspan put. That Greenspan moved to a behavior of signaling any unfavorable to the markets move well in advance, and if there was any serious liquidity problem, or which in cases was actually more like a solvency problem. I mean, remember, we actually had to bail out Mexican banks, which was really a bailout of U.S. banks. I mean, the motives were completely different than what were presented. But, you know, so here we've established derivatives are destructive. Here we've established that we needed to bail them out. Instead of taking historically what would have been the reaction, we need to just think about derivatives. You know, there was a whole lot of investigations and discussion at the time about regulating derivatives. I mean, there was actually a lot of study that was successfully beaten back by the industry. And worse than it was sometime around, I remember gasping out loud when I read it in Institutional Investor, sometime around 1996 or 1997, Greenspan says, basically, we're going to let 1,000 flowers bloom. We're going to let these derivatives players do whatever they want, and we, the Fed, are just kind of look over their shoulders, and maybe we'll kind of nudge people into what we think is industry best practice, which turned out to be the value at risk model. So you had, concrete demonstration that this was a source of systemic risk, and yet not just no action, you actually have actual enablement of the problem on a couple of axes. And there we saw response patterns like that, you know, basically from the mid-90s onward, that we had what, and unfortunately we're way past correcting the language. You know, everybody talks about deregulation. I would almost argue that we had the system re-architected, that we had a system that was basically turned out being robust. I'm not sure the people who designed came up with the 33 and 34 Act, and their intent was to create stability. They actually did a very good job of designing, you know, systems that, you know, structures that created that end. And then it's basically they performed well over time. Increasingly, certain interest groups would basically say, "Oh, we want this waiver," and the waiver really wasn't to deregulate in the sort of the classic sense. We're going to have no rules, which is how most people think of deregulation. It's let's get a waiver that's going to help us and our friends. You know, people, you know, firms that are configured in a similar way, and it was basically the, you know, for example, the, you know, some of the earliest deregulation was one critical bit was in 1970 when the New York Stock Exchange, what we call deregulation, you know, the New York Stock Exchange relaxed its eliminated its rule whereby all NYSE members had to be partnerships, and that favored the firms that were big enough to raise capital in the public markets. There was a different argument at the time. The argument was, oh, we're having all these back office failures and firms are merging and we need cheaper sources of permanent capital. In reality, it favored the bigger firms. Similarly, Don Regan was a big proponent. Don Regan, then the head of Merrill Lynch, was a big proponent of deregulated commissions. Well, who is deregulated commissions going to favor the big people like Merrill? You know, so what has been sort of a lot of what was posed as deregulation technically was relaxing of existing rules succeeded in changing the configure in a lot of cases of the industry in a way that favored big players. I mean, the fact we've got more concentration is not an accident.
Talk about financial.
Go ahead. One point, you were talking very quickly, which is fine. But I don't write as well quickly. In terms of Mexico, now, in 1994, the Fed started to tighten, but they didn't tighten a little bit, they tightened a lot. Interest rates went from 3 to 5.75 in 25 basis point increments.
It was the first increment that threw everybody out. The first increment.
I see the reversal of policy from the easing after the recession.
It was a reversal actually precipitated crisis quite quickly.
And then you said it had losses that were exceeded those from the 87 stock market crash. Those were losses associated with
derivatives.
In Mexico?
No, Mexico was just one piece. I mean, Mexico was sort of a train wreck that was going to happen anyhow. So the Mexican crisis was kind of coincident with the interest rate increases, so that it overlapped that period. Mm-hmm. So you're right; I didn't parse those two issues out as probably as I should have. But it was the initial rate movement because everybody had been betting on declining rates, and you saw suddenly in the derivatives market people starting to unwind their trades, which then led to a worsening of the prices they were going to get on those trades. You saw sort of panicked, oh my God, we bet completely the wrong way on Greenspan.
I see. So that's why at the same time you would see. If you go back, whether it's Orange County on the inverse floaters or Gibson Greeting or Procter & Gamble, those were all interest rate plays, some of them kind of range-bound floaters.
Right.
That would have blown up with their interest rate reversal. And then I think the Kingdom of Belgium, too. I found this the other day. So the nation of Belgium lost $1.2 billion
right.
with Merrill, against Merrill. Doing
a lot of waffles.
It is. You've got to takes a lot of. It's, yeah. Takes some mayonnaise off your. Then there was
a whole separate set of issues with derivatives, which is a real. And again, it's the more complex ones, it's the more customized ones. I mean, another thing which is troubling is when people talk about derivatives. You know, it's everything from interest rate, the simple swaps, which are not pernicious. I mean, the only reason LTCM blew up on interest rate swaps is they took 10% of the market. You take 10% of any market. That's like that, and it's all a unidirectional bet. You're going to be in trouble. I mean, so you can kill yourself in perfectly safe markets if you engage in stupid behavior. But XLTCM, you know, people have not hurt themselves with foreign exchange and interest rate swaps. If the simple ones, and if you're a customer, you can call around and get decent prices if you seek to. If you're big enough to be able to get multiple bids from people, and if you're really not big enough to get multiple bids from people, you probably shouldn't be arranging your own FX or interest rate swaps. But the more complex derivatives, the big problem is, of course, that people can't shop prices in any kind of way because, you know, the pricing components are all built in ways that are opaque to the customers. And, you know, I was doing derivatives work with one of the leading players in the early 90s, and they were just horrified at the market. And these were traders. Traders were horrified at the market practices. I mean, that's how bad they were. That they could see in their big competitor was Bankers Trust.
Which firm did you work for?
With O'Connor and Associates. So they were big equity and they weren't in interest rate derivatives to a meaningful degree. They were in equity and foreign exchange derivatives. But they would regularly be competing with Bankers Trust on the FX derivatives. And they definitely had the better modeling skills. There'd be sometimes some very complex deals that it might take O'Connor a weekend to figure out how to price, because you had to figure out how to hedge it to price it. And BT wouldn't be able to price, so it wasn't as if BT had some secret sauce that O'Connor didn't have. And they would hear in the marketplace of deals, or they could see them, because sometimes they would be swaps embedded in public deals or derivatives embedded, and they could just see the price was unbelievable. I mean, BT was just taking customers.
Spreads were enormous.
Well, yeah, the spread, what they would call, and that isn't called edge, but it amounted to the same thing. But again, it was bundled in ways the customer couldn't see because it was in volatility assumptions or certain parameters on the deal. They might sell them, again, the same collar products. How's somebody going to know when they're being sold a floor and a ceiling as a collar? Because the part they want is the floor. They don't know what they're giving
Belgium
up on the
ceiling. Belgium got a thing called power knockout options. That's what got Belgium. Mm. And your description of Bankers Trust is sort of the same as Frank Partnoy's. If you read his stuff.
Yeah.
It was
they were really a predatory organization. I mean, it's kind of openly so.
Yeah.
I mean, the tapes were down. I mean, the tapes just confirmed what people in the market knew. So.
Yeah, that's what got Gibson, because they would they couldn't shop around the bids, as you were saying. And so when they wanted to get out of something, they'd go back to Bankers Trust and go, oh, the market's moved against you a lot. So they're getting sort of off-market prices to get out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was bad enough that it was designed with a lot of margin built in. Then on top of that, they were getting nailed every time they tried getting out. Yeah.
What made this crisis worse than all other crises?
First thing, it was that it was across markets. We had a phenomenon where, because of, again, the structural changes in the industry and because behavioral changes among investors, normally when you see crises are typically limited to sort of one asset class. Like, even though the dot-com bust was a big wipeout in value terms, it was still U.S. stocks. What you saw happen was that increasingly you had very, very large firms who had very cheap cost of capital, who engaged in and you saw spread compression across. I mean, if you looked in the 2006 period, even though what people have focused on is the housing market in the U.S., you saw tremendous spread compression across all risky assets. I mean, it was just all the spread. You know, if you went junk bonds, even muni credit to a degree. I mean, the premiums people pay for emerging market stocks, not very directly in the crisis, but you just saw the spreads for all kinds of risk assets were just insanely narrow. So you effectively, and one big trigger for that was the way you had not only de-equitized the system because of, you know, the leverage at the big players and increased use of derivatives, which allow for additional leverage, you also saw the use of basically vehicles that had then structures that had embedded leverage in them, like collateralized debt obligations. So you had all kinds of sort of axes of leverage being built into the system, a lot of which the regulators weren't on top of because, you know, it was in purviews that they didn't have very good supervisory powers to go really see what was going on. I mean, even now I'm frustrated, you know, because one thing I wrote about in my book Econ was the role of collateralized debt obligations, and in my book that was the detonator of the crisis, and yet that hasn't really, the abuses in that market still haven't really been explored to the degree that they should have been.
What was the real problem with CDOs, which is a question I've been tasked with?
There's the practical problem and then the problem that evolved in 2005-2006. The practical problem is that CDOs served as a purpose. Originally, they were developed in the 1990s. It was a small market. I mean, originally developed by Mike Milken, but in terms of actually being a real product, in an earlier subprime market, I mean, when subprime in the 90s was a much smaller market, and subprime really meant manufactured housing. So that was a place that dealers took. And again, the earlier subprime market was, you had characteristics similar to the later ones, where you had investments where tranched products, where you couldn't sell the riskier tranches. You know, buyers just didn't want them, which kind of shows you there's a problem with the deal. So somehow you securitize it, and there's not enough margin to go. You know, there's always going to, you know, on the one hand, you're always going to have one piece that's sort of the constraining piece, and instead of accepting the constraints of the constraining piece, they would basically make even more, and sometimes have more constraining. So instead of having like one tranche that was the difficult one to sell out.
Couldn't they have just over-collateralized it as a way to avoid having to,
even if you structure a deal, typically, there is even with more appropriate pricing, you're sort of never going to get it right. There's going to be sort of the one of the tranches is going to be the one that constrains demand with any structure. And then there tends to be a push to how to work around the constraints. And what happened with that process was, not only would they sometimes take, they began pushing the structures. CDOs allowed them to push the structures further, instead of having whatever was the least, you know, like with a pig, you know, what piece of the pig can't you sell? You know, the tail and the hooves or whatever, you know, and you can, and so they took the tail and the hooves and they turned them into sausage, right? That was the CDO. And the original CDOs were much more heterogeneous than the later ones, because even the subprime, the old subprime was a big part of it. The subprime was fairly small relative to other types of collateralized mortgage obligations, and you even see pieces of, like, and then they were also put in, like, whole pieces of equipment lease deals. So the earlier CDOs had subprime in them, but they were not subprime only. They really were basically sausage from other mm-hmm. types of deals put together. And that market imploded and the problem with CDOs, it turns out, is they ultimately wind up being a Ponzi, because nobody wants the lower tranches of the CDO. And so you have to keep rolling CDOs into other CDOs unless the market keeps in some form. And so unless the whole CDO market keeps growing, which it can't forever, eventually it's going to, you know, the music's going to stop. So
this is the second problem?
The first problem is inherently CDOs have a problem because they're designed to solve a problem of, we've kind of run into limits on a deal structure. And they tend to abuse the CDOs because the CDO is a natural Ponzi. You can keep rolling pieces of CDOs into other CDOs up to a point on the hard to sell pieces. So they're kind of problematic to begin with.
It's kind of like a Ponzi. If I could just pause you for a moment, because it's very fascinating, but you're going quickly. I wanted to clarify. For example, by Ponzi here, I think you mean not that the people who bought the senior tranche are necessarily going to lose, but rather that the guys who are issuing the trying to move the debt through the system, the issuers can't sell the more higher yield tranches. So the only way they can close the deal and go into the next deal is to roll some of the riskier high yield tranches into the next CDO. So it's not a Ponzi in that.
And the AAA worked in the old ones, right.
Right. So it's not that the guys who bought the AAA were at risk they didn't get out quickly, which is the traditional Ponzi risk for the initial investors. So it's different than that kind of Ponzi.
That's right. But it's a Ponzi in the sense that the whole structure depends on the market continuing to get larger.
From an issuer point of view, from a more liability side than the asset side, it was a Ponzi.
Yeah.
There always has to be a buyer.
Yeah, yeah. So in any event, the Gen 2, so what happened in Gen 2 when we had a much bigger subprime market that was different than the original subprime market is for some reason people came up with the idea, and I don't know how this could possibly, somehow they thought that the problem with the first one was somehow they thought that it was the assets of the first one, and that somehow having more diversified mortgages would really solve the problem. So weirdly, they went to approach with the second gen. When I say CDOs, I mean what they call the ABS, the asset-backed securities CDOs, because they're technically collateralized loan obligations are a CDO, even though most people don't refer to them in the media, don't refer to them as CDOs. But so I'm referring to people just call them also subprime CDOs. But what happened with the sort of Gen 2 version is when we started seeing fairly rapid growth in the subprime market, which really started in the 2003 period, you at first saw CDOs that were being purchased by what we call cash buyers. I mean, there were like real cash buyers who were buying these things. And then in a weird confluence of events happened in the 2004-05 period, the real cash buyers actually started getting nervous, both in the subprime market and in the CDO market. And around 2005, and I honestly don't know if this is just accident of history or sort of evil, that some people kind of understood the implications of what was happening. But it was in June 2005 that ISDA, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, came up with the protocol. I use the word protocol. They have a different term for it. I always call it protocol. The protocol that would allow for standard contracts on credit default swaps on asset-backed securities, which had never existed before. So suddenly doing a credit default swap on a subprime deal, which had been difficult before, suddenly became fairly easy. And some of these people, of course, you've heard of, the people like John Paulson, there had been the subprime shorts, had been trying to short the subprime market with not much success. I mean, they had succeeded, but they would have to go to banks, and deals would be hard to negotiate, they'd take a long time, and they could do it, but it was a really onerous, labor-intensive process. Suddenly, this made it easy. And there were the firms that were the leaders in this business went out pushing the idea of the subprime credit default swaps, and it was Paulson who allegedly it was Paulson, but I have a sneaking suspicion that Deutsche Bank came up with it and let Paulson take credit. So who knows who came up with this, but it was in the sort of Deutsche Bank universe. The claim is that Paulson actually came in with the idea that I'm going to fund the equity tranche of a deal and take the entire, all the credit default swaps created in a purely synthetic deal down, which means that he would basically put up 45% of the deal and have take 100% short positions, we would be net short 95 to 96% of the deal. And somehow you're going to find people to sign up for this transaction when the fact that he's doing the equity tranche gives him influence over the deal. I mean, it means that he can, at a minimum, say no on what goes into the deal. Because the whole assumption of the equity tranche is supposedly protecting all the long investors, when in fact it's just being used as a Trojan horse to create a better short.
It also funds the carry cost of paying for the credit default swaps and the
for his particular structure, only to some degree. And the structure that I wrote about in Econ, the Magnetar structure, it was quite explicit the way they designed it. And they probably did not get his net short. I mean, the way we ran the numbers, they were probably, whereas Paulson did he did mainly straight up CDS. So his would actually, he was probably taking other pieces of actually Magnetar type deals, other shorts. Paulson only did about $5 billion in CDOs that he sponsored directly, where he took the equity tranche, whereas Magnetar did, we think, at least $30 billion, and some people think more. Hmm. So Magnetar was the Magnetar trade was the real driver. And the problem with that, and what is not still widely enough known, is that you almost immediately saw abusive behavior. I mean, people like Lumineer say it was like you turned a light on. Like, suddenly in September, the third quarter of Lou Ranieri, the father of the mortgage-backed securities business. The
third quarter of which year?
Of 2005. So it was literally like 2.5 months, 2 months after the ISDA protocol. He said, you suddenly saw this huge change of behavior. You suddenly saw the market become, you suddenly saw a huge takeoff in the really toxic loans. And it's because you suddenly had demand for them, for these kind of CDOs. Because the shorts wanted the very worst sort of paper. Their activity of creating these bonds, if they used any cash bonds, they would actually directly be buying the worst possible cash bonds. If they were instead shorting them, the act of shorting them would... The act of actually placing them would distort spreads and again drive demand towards those kind of bonds. So either way, you saw either spread distortion or direct demand that was actually keeping the party going. And the problem is I haven't seen anybody put this together systematically. I've heard claims that something like 50 and 70% of the demand. I mean, so we proved it out in the book, but I've seen separately people said that they believe that 60 to 70% of the demand came from CDOs for subprime, that it was not any kind of, you know, real bona fide RMBS buyers.
You know, without revealing confidential information, we've seen that in a lot of the information that we've gathered, and so I think that's an accurate observation.
Yeah. So in any event, the perverse part is that this wound up at the dealer banks. And the reason this wound up at the dealer banks was that either you had firms that were actually buying AAA tranches because they could gain bonuses with them. That was big at the European banks, particularly UBS. Because if you bought it was called the negative basis trade. If you bought a AAA, AAA CDO, and those usually paid so let's say they're all priced off LIBOR. Let's say it yields LIBOR plus somewhere between 20 and 30. Let's say LIBOR plus 30. Because you're a European bank and you have cheap deposits, you actually fund under LIBOR. So your funding cost is maybe LIBOR minus 20. So you've got 50 basis points between your funding cost and what you're getting on the CDO. In those days, you could hedge that for less than the spread. So you could hedge the whole thing for maybe 20, 25 basis points. So you've got 25 basis points of what is treated. It's not just merely treated for the trader's books as free money. Under the Basel II rules, this required no capital. And the way that was treated effectively in how it was accounted for on the trader's P&L was as if all the future income was discounted to the present. That it wasn't just a 25 basis points this year, it was a 25 basis points in all the future years. And you'd literally hear traders, I was hearing this in New York, not knowing what they're talking about, like, I did this trade today and we freed up $25 million worth of capital. That freeing up that $25 million worth of capital was counted towards his bonus pool. Yeah.
Mr. Scott, could I go back over this, just a few details? So the idea is that you get a AAA tranche in a CDO or some other structured security, and then you hedge the interest rate risk for a LIBOR swap, and you buy credit protection from, let's say, a monoline or AIG, and you end up with 25 basis points without either credit risk or interest rate risk, and then you capitalize that 25 basis points to the present, and that just looks like risk-free income you generated today, and that will hopefully go in, or at least 10% of it, into your bonus.
Right, and the trader was doing this all. This was like the easiest.
Just wanted to fill in those.
This was the easiest trade on the planet. Yeah. And then I've been mystified as to why the American banks wound up with this, and it turns out we've now learned that Merrill, the biggest player, was engaged in this Pyxis trade that Louis Story wrote about in the New York Times, where basically they were effectively shuffling it among different vehicles, claiming some of them were unrelated when in fact they were related. So they were somehow shoving them off the balance sheet to keep the machinery going. So they were effectively, the traders had effectively found a way to game the reporting system to keep the party going.
You know, the big banks that accumulated a lot of the super senior positions, were they motivated by something similar, or was it just because they couldn't, somebody had to buy them in order to be able to sell the rest of it? You know, for example, Citi is the most famous.
Well, the Citi I'm the most mystified with, because Merrill had a mandate from. I thought originally that Merrill was just a pipeline problem, that they had lost the head of their CDO business, and management said, we're not going to lose our market share. You know, you must meet these targets, and so they kept doing deals and had nowhere to put them, and then they created these complicated kind of musical chairs that looked like they had sold it to some party, but it actually was round-tripping it through parties that really weren't unrelated. So Merrill really still was a pipeline problem in large measure, but they had more sort of chicane around it than I realized. Citi's kind of a mystery. I don't understand. I mean, so my theory is that the banks had pipeline problems, that they somehow thought they still had to keep being in this market, and somehow nobody told, you know, that they kept ginning up product thinking they were going to sell it and then got caught when the music stopped. Because the originators still have, again, it's back to bonus incentives. The originators still have incentives. As long as they originate a deal, if it's somebody else's, you know, some of these groups were integrated, where the guys originating the deal were also people who placed it, but other ones had them separated, where the originators were different from the placement. So if you're an origination guy, your incentive is to keep originating. And if the guy can't place it, well, it's his problem. This is a market price. You know, we sold part of it. You know, we got our circles.
Did that become I've learned these initials recently. IBG.
Oh yes, IBG, IBG, YBG, yes, yeah. But yeah, so we had dreadful, and you had banks that had risk management departments that were organizationally weak. You have a risk.
Could you elaborate on that whole culture and the compensation culture? Because I know you've written a lot about that and been very outspoken about how compensation
drove a lot of these things.
I'm a big believer that we had the industry grow up with really develop really bad incentives. That again, the reason I bothered mentioning the partnership thing is I actually worked at Goldman when it was a partnership, and it created completely different incentives than what you see now. You know, the course, the one is the most obvious, that if you're not going to want to engage in risky behavior because everybody's jointly and severally liable. You know, you could lose everything.
You can't leave the firm as easily either.
Right, and that's the other reason. Yes, the partners would keep their capital tied up in the firm, which meant their succession is selling their stake over time to more junior partners. That means that junior partners aren't, the more junior or prospective partners aren't going to want to buy in unless they think it's a viable franchise. And they work there all day. They're going to know it's a viable franchise. So it's not as if you can do risky things and then dump it on your juniors. That doesn't work either. A third interesting effect was the industry had much less mobility, because you're not going to let somebody into a partnership unless you've observed them over long periods of time. You know, even though somebody theoretically could transfer in laterally, say maybe 5, 6, 7 years into their career, in practice that person is going to be very disadvantaged unless they're some kind of star, you know, real star from another firm. Because the partner's going to be nervous that they don't really know his temperament and they haven't observed him under enough stress conditions that they're really sure of all the wrinkles of his behavior.
Right, so the Abbey Gung will be going to be more of an afterlife issue than next year's bonus.
Well, it's certainly not at the partner and owner level, perhaps, but maybe at the line level.
Yeah.
The traders are going to miss.
Yeah, and so what's happened is the industry has gotten bigger. The industry's gotten much bigger. You know, partly because the investment bank started, you know, getting the waivers to encroach on what had historically been investment banking. You know, investment banking had much bigger margins than in the 80s than commercial banking. So they over time got waivers to get into that business, and as a consequence, it drove the margins down in investment banking. And if some banks therefore needed to get more capital, they went public. Ex Goldman, which got money from Sumitomo, and then went public much, much later. But you know, they needed some source of
basic. Goldman got money from Sumitomo?
Yeah, I actually structured that deal. And when I was at McKinsey, we hired Lazard. I mean, then I joined Sumitomo, and they would go around Japan saying we spent $500 million because of her. So, I mean, that sounds, you know, I hate to talk that way, but yeah, it was a very attractive deal. Sumitomo had such low cost, they had such low cost capital.
And this was in the
80s? 1980. The Fed approved the deal in 86. It was November 86.
Okay, so this is before the one for copper came issue
there. Yeah, oh, no, that's a different Sumitomo. It's a member of Sumitomo Group. That's Sumitomo, Trading, completely different company.
Oh,
it has the same name. Sumitomo Bank, even though they have lots of Sumitomos in the Sumitomo Group. So Sumitomo Bank is a bank, the trading company.
Sumitomai is the.
In any event, they all needed cheap capital to compete with the banks, and cheap capital and competing direct, you know, and they, you know, they also felt that global reach was more important to compete with the banks, so they started getting on each other's turf. So the commercial banks became more bank-like in their scale and began adopting, and both firms began sort of adopting hybrid management structures. I mean, it was, and, you know, the kind of, and this is on the institutional side. Obviously, retail banking is managed quite differently. But as a consequence, you've got firms that have serious, in my view, serious command and control problems. Because in the old model of investment banking, you had very narrow experts. You know, the partner who oversaw the mortgage bond business was a guy who'd been on the mortgage bond desk his entire career. And maybe you'd have maybe one layer over him, like a management committee member that maybe managed all of the fixed income, all the debt trading businesses. You might have sort of one other layer, but you basically had, you still had partners, people who had their capital at risk running major profit centers. So you had people with deep expertise and knowledge running each business. Now as the businesses have grown in scale, you've got, the top of these firms does not know these businesses. I mean, they just don't. I mean, the businesses, a lot of them got more complicated, things like derivatives. You know, some of them are extremely complex. And they've grown to a scale that the executive level of the firm are not sort of day-to-day hands-on operating managers. And the real profits are generated by what you call the producers. And the problem with this producer layer is that because now we have more mobility in the industry, these producers basically have boutiques that they can take with them. If a guy who's running a business leaves and takes his, say, his top two people, he has shot a hole in that franchise. I mean, it is going to be very difficult for the firm to backfill that space very quickly. And a lot of these businesses, even though they're standalone from a P&L basis, they have synergies with the other ones. So if you pretend to serve big global corporate customers and suddenly you don't have a guy who can do junk bond, if enough people of your junk bond team lead, you suddenly have a major product hold. You can't work with the big private equity firms. So until you sort of, there's a whole lot of neuroticism about the league tables. It's actually justified, unfortunately. So you've got a producer layer that really effectively holds senior management hostage in some meaningful way. And as a consequence, the functions that could theoretically control it, risk management, because one way to compensate for, people who aren't, people who don't really understand what they're doing, is to build really good, things like internal audit and really good risk management and have them be really quite independent and powerful. You could still, even with this sort of model of influential producers, if everybody on the street, felt they needed to have a tough risk management function, and if somebody left, there might be some cloud. Gee, did they leave because it was an opportunity, or gee, did they leave because maybe there was some problem? They were being reined in, and they tried peddling their franchise to somebody else. You'd have sort of different perception of the problem. But the guys who do risk, the guys in the risk management function, are paid a lot less. They just have a lot less clout, and they do have some incentives to not push, because the producers are unfortunately in this game more powerful. If they get in a fight, their instinct is going to be to back down too fast, even if they did have any political clout. Because if you're really doing a good job of risk management, you are probably going to call a few where you're wrong. We're going to say, gee, we really shouldn't do that trade, and the trade will work out. And in this environment where the producers are powerful, the producers will go in and scream, look, we didn't do that trade, and our three competitors did, and they go and do this chest thumping, temper tantrum routine, which is unfortunately very effective in these firms.
Right, but it's not, that should be the inherent job of the risk manager, is to, you're going to say stop more often than you need to.
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing it properly.
If you're doing it properly, if they understand that job, that is an inherent part of that job.
But the problem is that ultimately the senior management really won't back them, even though that's theoretically, there's a big disconnect between theoretically what they're supposed to do and how it operates in practice. If they lose, if they make, the traders have big hissy fits if they've missed business they think they should have had because of the risk manager. And the other thing is that the trader's typically going to be advantaged. If you go in and have a big argument about, I think you're carrying too much of this inventory, the trader is going to know that market better, will be able to blow smoke, if there's any doubt, quite often very effectively, if it becomes becomes arbitrated.
Yeah.
Go back to your comment earlier about regulation, and not really deregulation, but rather regulation favoring structural changes. Could you take us through how you think that changed over time? And
well, one of the most obvious ones is who's pushing. I mean, I saw this a little more closely. It was Citibank that was the big pusher of deregulation in the 1980s. I mean, in fact, it was sort of very comical, the way that Citi would spend tremendous amounts of money getting variances that helped them and other big banks. It was almost like they were spending money on, behalf of the rest of the industry in kind of a strange way. Not that they were acting as, any kind of formal lobbying role, they acted, but it was almost as if they were doing free lobbying for other big banks. It was Citibank who pushed for more waivers on interstate banking. It was Citibank who pushed for a lot of the forms of more permissive capital treatment. And it was a view that it would advantage them. And in fact, the whole idea of having, and even though you did still have the firewalled, the securities business still had, limits on it. It was not supposed to use deposits and all that. Still the banks still had, they were doing crazy stuff when they were a client of mine, you couldn't believe what they would do. They basically bought and sold the company in something like 1984, just to show they could do it. And banks are supposed to do that. They literally took like different pieces of balance sheets and moved it through the bank and like pushed it out the other side just to show that they actually could secretly take, you know, different pieces of the entire capital structure of a single firm and shove it through Citibank, just given the waivers they'd already gotten.
So this is separate from that 1987 ruling that led to Volcker's leaving the board, where they the Federal Reserve Board overruled Volcker, and then they allowed banks to engage in commercial paper, issuing asset-backed commercial paper, and a whole range of other what we think of sort of capital market activities that seem to be not a complete but a significant rollback.
Well, yeah, Citibank, and that I don't know personally Citibank's role in it, but I would imagine Citibank was big in pushing that because Citibank at the time had the biggest money market operation by far of all the banks. And again, that was a time when Citibank had a very big treasury operation in London, but was competing directly with the European banks that were universal banks. That was a big argument. The U.S. banks were using, oh, we have to really be able to do everything that universal banks can do. We're like at a terrible disadvantage in all these international centers. You know, you must let us do it here because we'll build more expertise and, you know, we'll have advantage in our home market relative to them. You can question the validity of those arguments, but that was one of the ways those arguments went.
So who are they making these arguments to?
Since I wasn't directly involved in the lobbying, I mean, their vice chairman, oh God, I can't remember his name, but their vice chairman.
Rhodes?
What?
Rhodes?
No, earlier. It was a German, his name actually was, his first name was hyphenated. This is a guy in the early to mid-80s. But no, their vice chairman was basically in charge of pushing for the regulatory, various forms of regulatory relief. It was his full-time job, pretty much.
I'm drawing blank. I used to work for Citibank during that time.
Okay, well, no, it wasn't Rhodes. I think the last meeting was the middle of the D.
It'll come to me after I leave here.
What?
After I leave here, it'll come to me.
You're having a senior moment.
Completely
changing the topic. Or maybe not. Do you think the crisis was caused by the subprime? Well, the collapse of the housing crisis and the subprime meltdown, or do you think that that was just a trigger and something else could have triggered it? We've heard opinions in both directions where people have said, not for subprime, there'd be no problem, things would go on, yada, 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 and others have said subprime could have been something else.
Okay, well, the subprime, again, it comes back to, if it really had just been subprime, Bernanke would have been right. It would have been contained. We would have had a very painful recession, but not necessarily a global financial crisis. I keep coming back to that we had so much interconnectedness, the fact that we had basically a shadow banking system built up that was close to the size of, you know, nobody's got a real good measure because there's questions about double counting, but the more people are putting numbers together, the more they're coming up with numbers that it probably was the size of the regulated banking system that basically had close to zero equity in it. So it was not going to take much to push this over. So I think we would have seen some form of a crisis. And then we had all these linkages. We had the fact that the shadow banking system used repo, and that if the collateral values collapse, that ripples across a lot of firms very quickly.
Let me ask you something about that. It's actually, we spoke to somebody else just a couple of days ago about you know, contagion or linkages or interconnectedness. And there, the other person with whom we spoke raised the issue of, it wasn't so much that people were interconnected, but rather that they basically all had the same assets. And so that whether or not they were trading with each other, they would have failed together given their leverage structure and the asset classes that they had. And he used as an example of, did anybody fail because Lehman went under other than the primary reserve fund? Maybe not. Of course, you can't take away the government intervention and assistance to the markets. But I don't know. Do you think that actually firms were such that the failure of a Lehman or a Bear without government assistance to the rest of the system would have necessarily brought somebody down? Or would it have been a investor panic, which would have caused the kinds of problems? The difference of whether there was actually balance sheet impact or the mark-to-market investor panic kind of overreaction.
You're getting back to, but I think these are not unrelated questions. If you accept the notion that the risk spreads were too tight, that a mere correction of to normalcy, if you have a shadow banking system with not enough equity, is going to create price declines that lead to insolvency. So the issue is how there was virtually no equity in the shadow banking system. It would not take much in a way of repricing to make the whole thing start falling over. And I do think the connectedness is still an issue, because you do have firms lending to each other, and that leads to, now admittedly that leads to liquidity. It's not a solvency problem, but you actually have a solvency problem that is then compound, that when somebody recognizes somebody's insolvent, it's like, in any run, that becomes a broader set of runs. It's first that, oh, that bank's in trouble. And then you think, well, who are the customers of those banks? Who got hit by that? You know, maybe I should cut back my credit exposure to them. I don't know if they were. So even in systems which don't look like they're highly interconnected, you have exactly this kind of behavior. I think it was a solvency, not a liquidity issue. I mean, because there was just too little equity in the system, too much stuff with bad credit risk. I mean, it was the LBO loans too. I mean, they probably may not have repriced in such a dramatic manner. But if we didn't have the super cheap credit, those LBO loans would have been bad. I mean, if we had continued sort of on this normal credit tightening, they're just way too many of these LBO players were levering up these firms and paying out special dividends. I mean, a lot of those would have fallen over X, but a lot of them have now been able to refinance on pretty favorable terms, thanks to tons of intervention.
Do you agree with the premise that everyone had the same portfolio?
The U.S., yes and no. I mean, because you have the complicating factor of J.P. Morgan Chase, which sort of nominally had less exposure to subprime in the normal sense, but they had big second mortgages exposures, and they have a huge derivatives clearing operation. So their profile looks quite different. But I've heard the people are the reverse of the convention. People who I trust their judgment. You probably spoke to Chris Whalen, but Chris Whalen is very much of the view that if anyone had gone down, J.P. Morgan was next. Absolutely contrary to J.P. Morgan's PR, because of their clearing relationships. And let me look what happened to State Street. I mean, I'm not as up on State Street, but the clearing banks are quite different, and they were in terms of their profiles, and they were proven to be vulnerable. So even firms that look different, in terms of their business mixes, were very much exposed.
Okay. I don't myself. I think these firms have very different portfolios, but I was curious.
That's what I'm saying. I think people make that argument thinking of the U.S. investment banks. The U.S. investment banks still have very different profiles, even though the European banks bought a lot of U.S. paper. The European banks obviously had. I think people tend to think of this as a U.S. crisis. And the European banks had very different business mixes, but they still had enough U.S. paper and low enough equity levels and enough other sort of problems in their funding profiles that they were still, were proven to be vulnerable.
Yeah, they got tied together through interbank lending, shadow banking, repo, as well as...
And then some individual stupidity, like some several banks who bought, like, the wrong assets, late in the game, wrong banks, at really high prices, so they got whacked that way.
Now you talk about how the shadow banking system created interconnectedness that made it more of just a subprime crisis, but more of a system-wide crisis. What about the role of derivatives?
Well, derivatives linked the whole thing together, and that was through repo, because people then needed more. That was another sort of driver of the need for more AAA instruments, was the fact that the more derivatives you're writing, the more collateral you need for repo. And the system began to, and historically, repo was just treasuries. I mean, repoing something like a treasury is a no-brainer because you've got no payment risk. People began accepting AAA paper that really people knew wasn't AAA paper. Like, you even talked to the bond insurers. They actually didn't think this AAA paper was AAA. They thought this is AAA, at worst, good single-A paper. You know, that's how it's being priced. But it was, stunningly, it was accepted in the repo market as if it were AAA. And since it was funding derivatives positions, if it goes down,
by funding you mean there were, how would you
funding support. People would require a certain amount of margin to be posted for a derivatives mm-hmm. position. So they would use repo. They would use repoable instruments. You could either post cash as collateral, or you could post an instrument suitable for repo, or you could repo something to raise the cash to use for, to provide the collateral.
I see. In other words, the dealer would accept the AAA structured security as initial margin or variation margin, because the dealer knew they could repo it and get cash for it.
Right. Yes.
And the
haircuts were very low. The haircuts on ABS CDOs were something like, on Treasuries it was something like 2%. I think it was lower for Treasury. It was only 4% for AAA ABS CDOs. So you would get 96 cents on the dollar for that stuff, and then it began decaying in 2006 and 2007 to basically nothing by the Lehman crisis. Nobody would take it.
And then
that forces a contraction. You know, suddenly you have people who have derivatives positions. They can't. You know, what do you do with the derivatives positions? Then you have to close it down, presumably at a loss, because everybody else has derivatives positions. You know, suddenly we're in a volatile environment. The vols have spiked out.
Is there any other way the derivatives market might have created interconnectivity other than through the linkage with the repo market due to the need to collateralize the OTC derivatives transactions?
Well, the other one is sort of the JP Morgan problem. You've got big clearing institutions that are exposed. So again, if they haven't gotten adequate margin, you've also potentially got the hub. It comes to the same thing. It just looks a little different. It's you've got the firms exposed to their daisy. You've got the firms, so the ones that were doing bilateral repos, although that was becoming less common. And then you've also got the effect on the ones where they're doing it through a central. And I'm just not
the
on top.
Of that.
Yeah, I'm just not on top of how much of the market. Because I think most of the market actually was tri-party by then, but I'm not 100% sure. That's just not something. I haven't gotten that far into the weeds.
It depends on how you measure it, I suppose. Because a lot of the bilateral in treasuries and agencies is netted down through FIC, mm-hmm. and then that makes it look smaller.
Right.
So if you look at it in terms of outstanding, the tri-party looked bigger because there's no netting. But in terms of the dollar value of transactions, it's ambiguous because no one keeps track of anything but the net, not the gross, right? I mean, FIC does, but that's not what they publish. That's not what the Fed publishes.
Right.
So.
Right.
But it's
right.
But even the stuff, the bilateral clear through FIC, which is a subset of the total bilateral, that was still pretty big, even if it got to be smaller than the trilateral.
Yeah.
But you said earlier,
the second set of cross market exposures, which is the way investors started investing. You had more investors. You had both more global macro funds and more even private investors that were doing sort of quasi-global macro strategies, which meant that when the markets, and so anybody, any of those people who were levered, when one asset class got hit and they got hit by margin call, if you have any other option, you are not going to want to sell your most distressed asset in a distressed market. You are going to sell something else. And this is something we saw particularly in September and October 2007. You could see in the middle of the day.
This is the quake argument.
Yeah, you would see some unrelated market spike down. And it was very clear some trader was dumping a position, presumably because they were hit by a margin call. And since that market didn't look logical for a margin call, presumably it was they were dumping something because they needed to meet a margin call somewhere else. So that was
that sort of contagion that actually hits not the weakest but the strongest segment.
Yeah.
Earlier on, you mentioned also you were concerned about illiquidity, trading illiquidity in certain markets. I don't have the exact quote down. Was that an issue with derivatives? Was there any problems of a lack of trading illiquidity in that market?
Well, a lot of these things weren't that liquid to begin with. I mean, liquidity, for example, in credit default swaps. My understanding is it's limited to actually a fairly small number of contracts, even in the more robust days. So, but there was one thing that people talked about. I mean, this is just from the newspapers. They would talk about just how much liquidity there was in the markets, and then as you started seeing the short-term interbank funding pressures and nervousness about risk assets, you suddenly saw a lot. You know, suddenly people started running all these things they thought were liquid and they could trade out of. A lot of them they couldn't trade out of anywhere near in the sizes. They might still be able to trade, but their ability to trade in size was very much diminished.
When did you start getting nervous?
As when I started writing the blog. Probably a little before that, because I started writing at the very end of December 2006, and I could just see reading the Financial Times, this was going to end badly. And because the Financial Times had good credit markets coverage, the U.S. papers really didn't. And the gap between what I was reading in the Financial Times versus what I was seeing even on Bloomberg, which even though Bloomberg has good credit markets data, doesn't have a real depth of, maybe it doesn't as professional services, I don't get the, you know, the expensive one, but what you would see in its sort of news reporting, you didn't see much credit markets coverage, and certainly none in the Wall Street Journal of any meaning or the New York Times. I didn't think we'd have this kind of collapse. I somehow thought we'd have more of a, like a nasty grinding down over a period of time. You might see bumps, you know, you might see like bumps, but you wouldn't see like, bleh, you know, falling off a cliff.
A lot of people, although some of them were ignored, many of them were ignored, at least saw the decline in housing prices. Not too many people put the decline in housing prices together with a global financial meltdown. And I'm wondering why, because there were a few that, you know, that raised the issue, and they were, I think, what did Summers called, I forget who it was that he said was a Luddite.
Rajan.
Yeah. So is that something that just the whole system is incapable of looking at itself or being introspective or listening to voices that are out of the mainstream? Is that a problem?
That's part of it's a problem. Part of it is that there's several layers of it. One is that in general, business is much better telling its story than it was 15 or 20 years ago. Its ability to control and manage spend, and I've heard this from journalists, you know, there was just a big sea change over the 90s in terms of both the news cycles compressing and business getting far more sophisticated what they say and getting their message to the press. With a compressed news cycle, a journalist is going to have a very hard time getting the other side of the story. It's just the barrier has been moved in a way that's unfavorable to objective reporting. The second is that we had increasingly the Federal Reserve believing higher asset prices were a good thing. And I don't know where they got that headset from. I mean, that's very, you know, Greenspan was famously obsessed with stock market prices. I mean, when I read that in, there was a Wall Street Journal article in May 2008, I was horrified. I was completely horrified. What is the Fed doing? This has never been the Fed's job. To care about stock market prices, and it wasn't like he cared because he thought there was a stock market bubble and there might be a problem. The article made clear this had been a very long-standing obsession of Greenspan's, and he was spending the time of good young Fed economists puzzling out how stock market, like the sort of aggregate level of stock market prices, was formed. And you had Bernanke I should know whether it was 2005 or 2006, but he gave some very disconcertingly reassuring statements about, because you saw alarming fundamental signs. You saw how savings in the U.S. went to zero, pretty much. I mean, they even were negative for some quarters. I mean, that should be an extremely troubling sign, you know, sustained period of, you know, you should only see that in some kind of, you know, shock when people are having to draw down their savings in an emergency. You know, if we had some sort of short-term crisis, to see no consumer savings in a nominal economic growth period should have been an enormous red flag. And instead Bernanke gets up and says, well, it's really okay. You know, consumer, if you look at consumer balance sheets, they still have, you know, more equity than debt. You're going, consumer is not a business. they have to service the debt.
Well, that actually raises a nice segue. We interviewed Paul Krugman a month ago or so, mm-hmm. And at the end of the interview, we asked him if everybody was a Minskyite, mm-hmm. And because I said something about we're all Keynesians now, but are we all Minskyites now? And he said, "Yep." I don't know whether you have a view on that, because that's really his third stage of. Of the economy, in the Ponzi stage. Do you have a thought about that?
No, I mean, I think Minsky's been proven right, and I think we've got the corollary that it wasn't just that people got more comfortable with lending. We got comfortable with institutions that were more levered. You know, the notion that, I mean, I was at McKinsey in sort of the early days of securitization. And the message McKinsey was giving to, and I wasn't on any of the studies, so I'm not personally guilty. But the message of McKinsey to all of its banking clients was, you're going to be on this bus, or you're going to be under the bus. And the reason that, and they had a little sort of chart. McKinsey hardly ever has standard charts, but once in a while for like really big trends, they'll like have a standard chart. Because it's much more profitable for them to sell custom work, contrary to everybody's image that consultants resell the same thing over and over. That showing how securitization was inherently cheaper, and it was entirely the savings on bank equity and FDIC insurance. Their chart said it was regulatory arbitrage. Couldn't be more unambiguous. And regulators can't not have understood that. And they endorsed this. There was more efficient use of bank capital. That was the rationalization. So somehow, regulators got in this headset, I'm not close enough to how the discussions went with more of the FDIC types, as to how they were persuaded of this view that more efficient use of capital was a good thing. But that was clearly embraced as a way of thinking.
So then, stepping back, another question that we ask is whether the failures, and I imagine there's plenty of failures to go around, was it a systems failure or a failure of individuals?
Oh, it was a systems failure. There, you can point to individual decisions that could have been made better. I mean, there's no sort of question any time things go badly that might have alleviated some of the damage, or made it more attenuated, which would have, reduced the severity of the impact on certain players. But this was cooked over a very long period of time. And we had financial firms, we have made a decision as advanced economies that we are going to backstop financial systems. We had already made a decision that we were going to, a long time ago, backstop depositaries. I don't think anybody realized until the crisis that we were going to actually backstop investment banks. I think if you told anybody in 2005 that all the investment banks were going to be bailed out in some form, they would have thought you were smoking something very strong. But if you're going to have a system where you have you're not going to let a financial crisis go too far, and you've adopted policy measures per securitization, which push significant amount of what was on balance sheet into financial markets, you therefore are going to wind up backing up those credit markets. That is what happened in the crisis, and you've got a model with terrible incentives. I mean, if you're going to let people take that kind of risk, you need to really regulate them like crazy. And instead, we went to the reverse. I mean, we not only, we not pushed into markets and said, it's fine, they're grown-ups, they'll discipline each other. Wrong. So, I think this was inevitable. I mean, just given this whole model where, and the banks, the bad incentives with the bank management level, the banks themselves, just like all of America, became very short-term profit-oriented. And the traders are, measured on 1-year bonus cycles and, so forth and so on. And there isn't a longer-term overlay. Even though people in the old Wall Street partnerships were paid in a 1-year cycle, the management itself, basically the senior management was the risk management function. Instead of having this disempowered separate body, that was part of every partner's job was risk management. So the partners themselves could let people be aggressive because they were very careful about setting parameters around the aggressiveness. And when you took that off, it was, no limit or close to no limits on what resulted.
What if you had subpoena power, which we do? Mm-hmm. What would you like to know?
I think there was even more collusion in the CDO market than people know about, and I think it would be I think it would be helpful to expose the degree of both what amounts to criminality and the fact that the way the laws have been written makes it very difficult to prosecute anybody for what ought to be criminal behavior. I think that message has not come out strongly enough, and I think it's very uncomfortable, and I think people like you are in an uncomfortable position if you discover really bad stuff, and it's like the whole system was set up with such fragmented, set up or evolved, let's put it more this way, evolved in such a way that enough people had plausible deniability or they shifted responsibility. But if you look at the whole pattern, it was clearly questionable. I mean, one of the things is the role of the investment banks in funding the CDO managers. The CDO managers all lived off investment bank credit. And I believe, but am in no position to prove, that the what increasingly happened on the deals, on the original subprime deals, was that they could place the AAA tranches. They could place the equity, for completely different reasons. They could always place the equity tranche of the original sub, not the CDO, but the subprime deal, basically because it had so much over-collateralization and it paid out pretty quickly. So there's actually like a small group of hedge funds that would buy. And the equity tranches are really skinny. They were only like 1%. So you didn't have to sell that much. So it was like there was like a group of buyers who liked the equity tranches. So on the original subprime deals, you had a problem basically with the AA through the BBB, all those, that part of the deal. I have reason to believe, but can't prove, that you would have CDO managers buying the entire bottom, that all of that from in single deals, all of that, taking that, and then parsing it out among different CDOs, which meant you had no arm's length pricing on this. Absolutely none. And the notion that these were priced in any kind of, you know, way that you could have market discipline on the first stage sort of points to even more abusiveness and collusion in what was going on.
Since there wasn't much of a secondary market, those primary market sales were the price discovery point.
Right.
And then
that determined the price in which they were sold into the CDO. So you had these phony prices because none of this was priced, you know, bought by asset managers, then placed in CDOs at phony prices. You could almost argue if these prices were phony, they were put into CDOs with embedded losses. There might even be reason these CDOs blew up, independent of people like Paulson and Magnetar picking the ones that were bad.
Right, and aside from credit rating agencies' risk management models that might have misjudged the correlation.
Was that Lamb a comment on credit rating agencies?
Well, because you know everybody had a different model than the rating agencies. Everybody knew it was all this wink and nod. You know, that the rating agencies would say, well, we'll give you our model. And basically, if you game it too close to the model, we want to prove it. But this is kind of what we're looking for. I mean, that's what it was like.
They were legally required to do that.
Yeah.
They say.
Mm. But if
I never heard that part. That's interesting.
No, it's true.
Okay.
We read the SEC regulations.
Okay.
But their models were focused on the correlation of losses.
Yeah.
And they didn't try to price the thing outright. So you could put in overpriced assets. And that wouldn't be
well. The other
up.
Thing is a correlation model. It's one thing I mentioned in the book. A correlation model is completely correlation. That's just a fundamentally intellectually wrong model to look at things at default. A correlation model is in highly correlated assets. The correlation models are based on the idea that if X price moves, and they're taking a derivatives notion and appropriately applying to the world of default. Correlation models say basically price of X moves this much, price of Y will only move that much, therefore if we put them together, there'll be some offset. A default is it's not a percentage game. If one defaults, the other way, it's binary. It either defaults or it doesn't fault. There's no like 0.3 default of the next.
The correlations all went to one at this point.
Yeah. So the idea that you could have, I mean, it's just, and this is just as in my view, I mean, derivatives people have said this was like completely goofy. I mean, now that they've thought about it, the derivatives people have bothered thinking about how the rating agencies' models work.
Well, and you think they had different models than the broker-dealers and other?
Oh, yeah, the broker-dealers had different models, which that means the broker-dealer models had the same, if correlation-based meant they suffered the same flaws. So this wasn't, the belief is that the investment banks had sort of more clever models somehow, and I don't know how their models were more clever.
I thought everyone used the Gauss and Coppola, and some people might have had more resources to modify it or what have you, but
yeah.
It was all basically the same model.
Yeah.
And So your point is that if you're...
Well, the flaw of the Gaussian, which people focus on with that, is just that you're finessing a problem that's not finessable. They're saying, well, we're going to use credit default swap spreads for the fact we don't have enough historical data. Well, the credit default swap spreads are based on no historical data, so they're no good either. I mean, they have no useful information in them either. How are they going to have... How is the market putting its finger in the air based on no historical information going to be any better? You still have a fundamental problem. The information is bad, and people are making uninformed estimates.
Well, yeah, that's the way sort of finance people think, I believe, is that market prices are valid measures of risk-neutral probabilities, and so in an Aristotelian type of sense of the wisdom of crowds, that is right.
But for crowd, that's one of these urban legends that the industry likes to believe, because all these studies on sort of crowds as proxies for, you know, crowd opinion as a predictor, you actually have to have a crowd that actually knows something. That has relevant. So
are we talking about the last election suddenly?
I remember you're on tape.
But in general, I mean, that's why elections are good, because everybody's, you know, hopefully a representative folks of voters show up and they can sort of collectively predict how they're going to behave as voters, right? They're an informed and representative group. If you had a bunch of trial lawyers formulating opinions on how much global warming we were going to have in the next 20 years, that would be useless. I mean, you think that would be a valid predictor of anything? And you've got people who are, it was to finesse an information problem. How are people going to know, based on no historical data of any relevance?
So you've fallen more in the actuarial camp of trying to assess fundamental
than
in the risk-neutral probability camp.
I just think that people making risk-neutral probability assessments when they have no historical... I'm not saying history would have been a good predictor, but having absolutely no history and thinking a market can predict based on no history, that's like trying to predict the weather when you don't have any meteorological training.
They traded options for several millennia before they developed the Black-Scholes model. So there's something.
But they're using historical prices, and you tend not to see options markets develop unless people actually have a sufficient depth in the underlying. It's priced in reference to an underlying. I mean, they had a great deal of difficulty starting. There's a really good in that what's that McKenzie book called? An Engine, Not a Camera. I mean, he talks about the difficulty they had about establishing new markets. The traders basically have to trade among themselves just for fun. And this was even in a pretty liquid market. You know, that was in S&P futures. That was where you actually had good price reference points. So you've got liquid. You know, even in instruments where you've got good pricing history, you still have liquidity. And weather, crops, the sort of historical derivatives. People do have some sense of, even though things blow out of historical norms, people have some sort of normative data. If you've got a brand new market like subprime, and you've got no historical, you have no historical analogies for floating rate subprime paper in the U.S. We had 30-year fixed to higher credit quality borrowers. How could you possibly? I mean, of course, this is hindsight is perfect now. But how could you possibly have? There may be other scenarios we could come up with where traders could come up with analogies in other markets that they could have reference points, or that they could have judgment-based views. There wasn't enough information about this particular product to have informed judgment-based views serve as a proxy for lack of historical information. That's my position on that. That's part of why it was a crock.
That's not unlike what the credit rating agencies told us. When we dug into their models and talked to the people that had the models, they said it eventually turned into a meeting where somebody said, well, we think it'll be this. There was no historical data.
Yeah.
Nobody knew what is a 228 mortgage or how people would respond to that.
The stuff that the street was producing after 2000, 2003 to 2007, was that sold or bought? I mean, did the street push it, or were there's actually a demand, or what?
Well, when you say the stuff,
I'm talking about the CDOs.
It's actually a really dreadful book in most respect, called "How I Caused the Credit Crunch Crisis" by a London derivative trader called Tetsuya Ishikawa, where he definitely gives the impression that the only way this stuff was sold was to chumps with liberal application of drugs and hookers and expensive alcohol.
It sounds like the movie.
Yeah.
You can sell anything with that.
Yeah, and the fact is, this stuff wound up in town councils in Australia, really unsophisticated people. I would say that a lot of this was sold. Now, I think early on, I would say in the earlier period, there, because when Greenspan had pushed interest rates down so low, I would say the earlier phases of the CDO, when you had real cash buyers, people were buying it. But then when you saw that, when people started getting nervous about subprime, more cash buyers started pulling back, it started flipping in the 2000, and again, it's hard to put a real, time point on it, but there was some time in the 2005-ish time frame when it flipped from being at least a AAA tranche, even the AAA tranche was starting to get to be more difficult to be placed. It went from being a product that was at least AAA tranches were bought because people wanted premium yield AAA paper to one that was increasingly sold.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how are we doing for time?
I think you have
3:25.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
I can't remember. There's liquor and horse. And what else was in that gift package that came?
Oh yeah, expensive alcohol, prostitutes, cocaine, and expensive.
Oh, drugs.
Yeah, drugs.
Okay.
No, it's on the table. You don't have to take
that. Okay, no, I'm sorry. It's probably not.
Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us? This has been great. And one of the nice things about interviewing you is that you talk so fast that we've gotten 2 hours out of the hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, sometimes being a little overly animated is a plus. I think you folks are put in a very unfortunate position, because the right way to have investigated this crisis would be for it to have been a global examination. To really have there been a coordinated effort between U.S. regulators, the U.K. and the ECB, and for there to have been a real serious forensic work, because there were so many elements of this that were not domestic, that no matter how good a job you do on understanding the domestic part, you're still going to have gaps in understanding because of what happened overseas and how those behaviors played back into what happened here. So.
I'm going to give you my card.
Okay.
We are actually speaking to Lord Turner in a week.
Oh, he's terrific.
If you have some questions that you think we ought to ask him, feel free to send them to us.
Well, he's got that. Have you seen his speech he did at INET? You should read that speech. He gave a phenomenal speech at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. They had a conference in April of this year, and he gave a fantastic speech. So read that speech.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's good. We've read, the Turner report. So.
Oh, and the other thing that you've probably also read, that you've read my favorite paper, the Andrew Haldane paper, the $100 billion question.
No, my God, you have to read that. That's like the most important one. Stop reading imaginable.
What's the last name?
Haldane, Haldane. It was March Haldane. He's Bank of England. It's March 2010. It's called the $100 billion question. And it is the most remarkable 30-page indictment of the financial system, not looking like he's out to indict it. He says basically, well, we just had this big global crisis. That makes the financial services industry kind of like a polluter. It imposed all these costs on other people because all kinds of innocent bystanders suffered. Normally what you do with a polluter is you either regulate it to death so that it doesn't produce any bad emissions or effluent, or you tax it because then at least it's not producing too much product artificially cheaply, and you can use the money you get for remediation.
Right.
Yeah. So he goes, well, let's look at what this crisis cost. And he goes through how he comes up with his numbers. But he basically comes up with, well, it cost, by any conservative estimate, 1 to 5 times global GDP. Well, let's assume these crises happen once every 20 years, which is kind of right, because either we have smaller crises that add up to the same thing, or we have a really big one. So if we were to tax the financial services industry over a 20-year period, for these once in every 20-year crises, what would it cost? Minimum of $1.5 trillion a year. The market capitalization of the biggest global banks is $1.2 trillion. So he's basically said that the industry is currently constituted is massively destructive and incredibly, of course, he doesn't actually say the bottom line because being British is so obvious. That extremely aggressive intervention in the industry is warranted given this equation.
Well, there's been the tiny attempts that have been made have been roundly criticized in the op-ed pages of the journal, so including by one of our commissioners.
Unfortunately, Obama had a window of opportunity that he blew.
You don't think Dodd-Frank goes far enough?
Absolutely not. I mean, the resolution authority does not work. You cannot have a national-based resolution regime when you've got international firms that are subject to international bankruptcy, and they still have not figured out a good way to wind down trading firms that are part of the critical global debt capital markets infrastructure. Because at some point, again, in a liquidation, you have to stop the trading. No one wants to be exposed and tied up that way. So they have two problems, if they were going to use that as the remedy, that are not fixed. I mean, I can go through other ones, but just the fact that the resolution regime concept is a non-starter. I mean,
you're right. It's limited in terms of its national scope. But what about the restructuring of the derivatives market?
That's now. I had a different view of what should have happened with derivatives, because as I said, that you had these like not pernicious derivatives that I think the plain vanilla swaps and FX swaps. There's no reason to move those into a clearinghouse, really. I mean, they are not troublesome.
They were already, at least in the interdealer market, in a clearinghouse.
Yeah. But the credit default swaps, I think, is a product with pretty much no... we have demonstrated it is highly destructive in its uses, and its alleged social benefits are non-existent. The big defense of it is, oh, it creates for better price discovery and liquidity in the bond market. Baloney. I never heard anybody complaining in the much less liquid bond markets that I grew up in of the early 1980s of anybody complaining about liquidity and price discovery. That is just an completely dealer-made up justification for a very high fee product that they do not want to give up. I mean, I would have much rather seen. It would be hard to shut that market down. I would have much rather seen that made costly and unattractive over time, and then maybe you see if you can shut it down, or maybe you have it still live in some, you know, much smaller and less offensive form.
And if you had credit default swap indices that were exchange traded, you would still find that having no social economic benefit.
No, I mean, why do you need anything other than people in the old days, in the old Stone Ages, people could grid bond prices perfectly fine by maturity and credit rating. And there were enough, even in the Stone Ages of the horrible markets of the early 1980s, there were enough liquid bond issues to trade it that you could do reference pricing just fine that everybody accepted if they wanted to trade in and out. This was not ever a problem. The industry has pretended
going short the bonds?
What?
How could you go short the bonds? Was anyone going...
Why? Nobody was complaining about the not being able to short bonds either. Seriously, nobody thought this. If you didn't like a, you know, most bond investors historically were longs, and why should we indulge hedge funds for the sake of earning 2 and 20 to mess up the economy? I'm really serious about this.
That's what Warren Buffett said. If you don't like the bond, sell it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, we have a speech by Greenspan where he was praising this as a way to disperse risk. Little did he know.
Little did he know.
Yeah.
So I'm not. So anyway, back to this. You know, the industry is a process of watering down. I'm afraid the other problem is there's a lot of customized derivatives that are legitimately difficult to clear and margin. And therefore, I'm very concerned the way this is going to wind up is the easy stuff it's going to get is going to wind up in a new too-big-to-fail entity, and where there's some risk that the banks will game it, find some way to game the fact that they move the less pernicious stuff over, and that the more difficult stuff will still sit in a significant degree on dealer books because they want it there, and they will be able to make, and some of it will legitimately be complicated enough that it'll be hard to move into a clearinghouse, and they'll be able to argue for other stuff that looks like it but really isn't that difficult because it's much more profitable for them to keep trading it. So I'm pessimistic it's going to be there.
You have to leave in a minute, right?
Yeah. Let me
ask you
one more. Yeah.
One more question, which I need to get out of you before we leave. You sort of talked about CDOs and subprime. Did subprimes drive the CDO market? Was there, if there was no, in 05, 06?
In 06, CDOs really were driving subprime. And that's, I think, not well, that's just not as well recognized. The significant buyers in the really toxic phase, certainly in 2006 and 2007, CDOs were driving demand for subprime.
So no CDOs, no subprime.
It would have started dying real fast, and you would have seen, because of the lack of demand, you would have seen the loans being repriced.
Hmm. That's your Ponzi point that we.
No, that's exactly that's the point that
you would have seen.
Well.
So the subprime market would have died a lot sooner.
Yeah, built up this apparatus.
You still would have had a subprime crisis, but it would have been much smaller. It would have died sooner under its own weight. The CDOs both kept the party going much longer, and actually encouraged the creation of the really, really bad mortgages.
Yeah, I think other people have made that same point, that you had an apparatus that was designed to have product, and they had to create the product. So. All right.
Perfect.
Well,
thank you.
This was fabulous.
Thank you. Excellent. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. Thank you. As Jeff would say, I'm